Random House Audio presents Things That Matter, Three Decades of Passions, Pastimes, and Politics. This is the author, Charles Krauthammer. Introduction. Section 1, The Book. What matters? Lives of the good and the great. The innocence of dogs, the cunning of cats, the elegance of nature, the wonders of space. The perfectly thrown outfield assist, the difference between historical guilt and historical responsibility. Homage and sacrilege in monumental architecture. Fashions and follies and the finer uses of the F-word. What matters? Manners and habits, curiosities and conundrums, social and ethical. Is a doctor ever permitted to kill a patient wishing to die? Why, in the age of feminism, do we still use the phrase women and children? How many lies is one allowed to tell to advance stem cell research? What matters? Occam's razor, Fermat's last theorem, the Fermi paradox, in which the great man asks, with so many habitable planets out there, why in God's name have we never heard a word from a single one of them? These are the things that most engage me. They fill my days, some trouble my nights. They give me pause, pleasure, wonder. They make me grateful for the gift of consciousness. And for 3 decades they have occupied my mind and commanded my pen. I don't claim these things matter to everyone, nor should they. I have my eccentricities. I've driven from Washington to New York to watch a chess match, twice. I've read Stephen Hawking's A Brief History of Time, also twice, although here as a public service, to reassure my readers that this most unread bestseller is indeed as inscrutable as they thought. And perhaps most eccentric of all, I left a life in medicine for a life in journalism, devoted mostly to politics, while firmly believing that what really matters, what moves the spirit, what elevates the mind, what fires the imagination, what makes us fully human, are all of these endeavors, disciplines, confusions, and amusements that lie outside politics. Accordingly, this book was originally going to be a collection of my writings about everything but politics, things beautiful, mysterious, profound, or just odd. Working title, There's More to Life Than Politics. But in the end, I couldn't, for a simple reason, the same reason I left psychiatry for journalism. While science, medicine, art, poetry, architecture, chess, space, sport, number theory, and all things hard and beautiful promise purity, elegance, and sometimes even transcendence, they are fundamentally subordinate. In the end, they must bow to the sovereignty of politics. Politics, the crooked timber of our communal lives, dominates everything because in the end, everything, high and low and most especially high, lives or dies by politics. You can have the most advanced and efflorescent of cultures. Get your politics wrong, however, and everything stands to be swept away. This is not ancient history. This is Germany, 1933. Beauty is truth, truth, beauty, that is all you know on earth and all you need to know. Every school child is fed. But even Keats, poet, romantic, early 19th century man oblivious to the horrors of the century to come, kept quotational distance from such blissful innocence. Turns out we need to know one more thing on earth, politics, because of its capacity when benign, to allow all around it to flourish, and its capacity when malign to make all around it wither. This is no abstraction. We see it in North Korea, whose deranged Stalinist politics has created a land of stunning desolation and ugliness, both spiritual and material. We saw it in China's Cultural Revolution, a sustained act of national self-immolation designed to dethrone, debase, and destroy the highest achievements of 5 millennia of Chinese culture. We saw it in Taliban Afghanistan, which just months before 9/11 marched its cadres into the Bamiyan Valley and with tanks, artillery, and dynamite destroyed its magnificent cliff-carved 1,700-year-old Buddhas, lest they, like kite-flying in music and all things lovely, disturb the scorched-earth purity of their nihilism. Politics is the moat, the walls beyond which lie the barbarians. Fail to keep them at bay, and everything burns. The entire 20th century, with its mass political enthusiasms, is a lesson in the supreme power of politics to produce ever-expanding circles of ruin. World War I not only killed more people than any previous war, the psychological shock of Europe's senseless, self-inflicted devastation forever changed Western sensibilities, practically overthrowing the classical arts, virtues, and modes of thought. The Russian Revolution and its imitators, Chinese, Cuban, Vietnamese, Cambodian, tried to atomize society so thoroughly, to war against the mediating structures that stand between the individual and the state, that the most basic bonds of family, faith, fellowship, and conscience came to near dissolution. Of course, the greatest demonstration of the finality of politics is the Holocaust, which in less than a decade destroyed a millennium-old civilization, sweeping away not only 6 million souls, but the institutions, the culture, the very tongue of the now vanished world of European Jewry. The only power comparably destructive belongs to God, or nature, or if, like Jefferson, you cannot quite decide, nature's God. Santorini was a thriving island civilization in the Mediterranean until one morning, 3,500 years ago, it simply fell into the sea. An earthquake, a volcanic eruption, the end. And yet even God cannot match the cruelty of his creation. For every Santorini, there are 100 massacres of innocents. And that is the work of man, more particularly the work of politics, of groups of men organized to gain and exercise power, which in its day-to-day conduct tends not to be the most elevated of human enterprises. Machiavelli gave it an air of grandeur and glory, but Disraeli's mordant exultation, "I have climbed to the top of the greasy pole," best captured its quotidian essence, grubby, grasping, manipulative, demagogic, cynical. The most considered and balanced statement of politics' place in the hierarchy of human disciplines came naturally from an American. "I must study politics and war," wrote John Adams, "that my sons may have the liberty to study mathematics and philosophy, geography, natural history and naval architecture, navigation, commerce and agriculture, in order to give their children a right to study painting, poetry, music, architecture, statuary, tapestry and porcelain." Adams saw clearly that politics is the indispensable foundation for things elegant and beautiful. "First and above all else, you must secure life, liberty, and the right to pursue your own happiness. That's politics done right, hard-earned often by war, and yet the glories yielded by such a successful politics lie outside itself. Its deepest purpose is to create the conditions for the cultivation of the finer things, beginning with philosophy and science and ascending to the ever more delicate and refined arts." Note Adams' double reference to architecture. The second generation must study naval architecture, a hybrid discipline of war, commerce, and science, before the third can freely and securely study architecture for its own sake. The most optimistic implication of Adams' dictum is that once the first generation gets the political essentials right, they remain intact to nurture the future. Yet he himself once said that there never was a democracy yet that did not commit suicide. Jefferson was even less sanguine about the durability of liberty. He wrote that a constitutional revolution might be needed every 20 years. Indeed, the lesson of our history is that the task of merely maintaining strong and sturdy the structures of a constitutional order is unending, the continuing and ceaseless work of every generation, to which I have devoted much of my life, and which I do not disdain by any means. Indeed, I intend to write a book on foreign policy, and if nature, or God, or nature's God, gives me leave, to write yet one more on domestic policy. But this book is intended at least as much for other things, things that for me as for Adams shine most brightly. Biologist and philosopher Lewis Thomas was once asked what one artifact we should send out into space as evidence of human achievement. I would vote for Bach, all of Bach, streamed out into space over and over again, he suggested, then added ruefully, we would be bragging, of course. Not a single State of the Union address, I'd venture, not one version of the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty, nor, God help us, what we actually did send out into space when we first got the chance. The interstellar Voyagers 1 and 2 carry, among other artifacts, the first audio greetings from our species. Who is it that, on behalf of all humanity that has ever lived, speaks to some unknown alien race across the infinity of space? Whose voice will survive into eternity long after Earth has turned to a cinder? Why, the head of the one political institution that represents all mankind, the then UN Secretary General Kurt Waldheim, later discovered to be a Nazi. A minor one, mind you, just a small, willing cog in the machine. Makes you wish that we'd immediately sent out a Voyager 3 beeping frantically, please disregard all previous messages. Thomas was right about Bach, though I do concede that beaming out a digital copy of the Magna Carta or the Declaration of Independence would have made a fine second choice. But here I draw a distinction. While political practice deserves grudging respect for its power, political philosophy commands reverence for its capacity for grandeur and depth, as exemplified by the sublime texts of the American founding. Accordingly, I have weighed much of the politically oriented writings in this volume toward those dealing with constitutional issues and general principles. I've skipped over much of the partisan contention that characterizes the daily life of a democracy, the tentative, incremental, ever-improvised back and forth that occupies much of the attention of a political columnist. I've tried to give as little space as possible to campaigns and elections, to personalities and peccadilloes, to things that come and go. These contingencies are not ignored, of course. They cannot be. That's not how actual political life is lived. But because these more transient, more partisan, more pole-climbing events tend to mundanity and redundancy, they lose their interest over time. They fade from memory, and deservedly so. I've tried to filter most of that out. I've tried to stick to what matters. Section 2. The Author. That's how this book was put together. For those listeners interested in how the author was, let me offer a brief account of my writing career. It is a measure of its improbability that until age 30 I had not the faintest idea or expectation of becoming a writer. I had a brief accidental stint in college, then quite casually left it behind for a decade, only to return to it by the sheerest serendipity. My first published article was a short, pompous editorial in the McGill Daily titled End of the Monolith. I got to write the equally pompous headline because I happened to be my own editor. It was a month into my senior year at McGill and my first day on the job as editor-in-chief. A week earlier, the student council had fired the previous editor on the grounds that the paper's mindless, humorless Maoism had rendered it unreadable. Yes, Maoism, Stalinism being too moderate and lacking in romance. This was, after all, the 60s. A search was launched for someone not loony left. The roulette wheel spun my way. By today's standards, I would have been considered a centrist, but on a 1969 campus, that was considered a fairly exotic, somewhat reactionary political orientation. So I decided to issue a manifesto clarifying the new management's creed. It was simple. The paper was now open to all points of view. The Daily is under the present editorship because it is committed to publish a pluralist paper, I wrote. Not only would dissenting and critical analyses be actively solicited, but henceforth, newsworthiness would be determined by no single ideological standard. Or, as I phrased it, by no one historical paradigm, Thomas Kuhn having made the notion of paradigm shift too voguish for any self-respecting 19-year-old to resist. Pluralism was not the most fashionable flag to fly those days, but unlike most of my contemporaries, I never had a Marxist phase, and if I did, it would have lasted no more than a weekend, undoubtedly a good one, I suspect, because I don't remember a minute of it. This devotion to pluralism reflected my aversion to the politics of certainty, so prevalent at the time, and in particular to the politics of the extreme. I had learned that lesson early. At McGill, I witnessed a mass rally to turn the university, then considered by the left a bastion of Anglo-imperialism, into a French-speaking school for the local proletariat. At the head of the march, linked arm in arm, were two men, McGill's most radical Marxist professor and the leader of a neo-fascist, anti-immigrant popular front. It was for me a seminal moment, visual, tangible evidence of the ultimate convergence of left and right, an object lesson in the virtues of ideological moderation, and my goodbye, if there ever was a hello, to political romanticism. It set my own political course toward philosophical skepticism and political tolerance. That didn't mean splitting differences or straddling some ideological midpoint. It meant viewing certainty with suspicion and acknowledging with both regret and resolve the imperfectibility of man, the fallibility of institutions, and the tragic rather than redemptive nature of history. When my senior year was up, I went on to pour myself into political philosophy at Oxford. It was there that I discovered my muse for this prudential view of the possibilities of politics, John Stuart Mill, whose On Liberty is the foundational document of classical liberalism. To this day, it's the first thing I recommend to any young person seeking political guidance, to be followed by Isaiah Berlin's Four Essays on Liberty, perhaps the finest and surely the most accessible 20th-century elaboration of that tradition. I say Mill's liberalism invoking the 19th-century understanding of the word. Today, that political orientation is the essence of conservatism. In the 20th century, liberalism became more ambitious. It outgrew the classical individualism of the Millian tradition and fell in thrall to the romantic progressivism of the age. Mill held that truth emerges from an unfettered competition of ideas, and that individual character is most improved when allowed to find its own way uncoerced. That vision was insufficient for 20th century American liberalism. Mill lacked sweep and glory. Modern liberalism's perfectionist ambitions, reflected in its progenitor and current euphemism, progressivism, seeks to harness the power of government, the mystique of science, and the rule of experts to shape both society and citizen and bring them both, willing or not, to a higher state of being. It was natural, therefore, that I would in time turn to conservatism. But that proved to be years away, largely because I then abruptly left the field and abandoned my studies. Mill had his crisis of conscience at 20. I had mine at 21. I had become increasingly uncomfortable with the life of theory. I began to regard it as something of an intellectual self-indulgence, increasingly divorced from reality and from duty. One morning that August, I called the registrar at Harvard Medical School, where I'd previously been accepted, to ask for immediate admission. Quite by chance, a student had just dropped out, a week before the beginning of the term. If I was there by Monday, the spot was mine. I didn't pack. I left immediately to take up what I was sure would be my life's work, the practical, the real, the indisputably worthy work of medicine. There I spent the next 7 years, a nice biblical sum, 4 as a medical student, 3 as a psychiatric resident at Massachusetts General Hospital. Medicine had not been my first choice. I had long preferred the graceful lines of physics to the ragged edges of biology. But at 16, I'd come to realize that I didn't have what it took to do important work in theoretical physics, namely genius. A friend in my special relativity class, who had come to the same awful conclusion about his own intellectual capacities, told me he was changing his major because he didn't want to end up testing steel for General Motors. The great physicist Max Planck did once tell John Maynard Keynes that he had thought of studying economics, but decided it was too difficult. That I take as an exercise in either humor or good manners. Not thirsting to test steel, I chose medicine. I have no regrets. It was challenging and enlarging. I absorbed more knowledge in those 7 years than at any other time in my life. Although it did turn out that I wasn't quite the perfect fit for psychiatry either. In my first year at Mass General, I discovered that all freshman residents were required to attend a weekly group therapy session. Seeing this as pointless, I refused. This did not go over well with management. Around week 7, I was called into the department chairman's office. He asked me why I had not been attending. "Because I came here to give therapy, not get it," I said. "You're just in denial," he protested loudly. "Of course I am, sir. It's the best defense mechanism ever invented. Why, I'm a master of denial. I should be a professor. I could give a course in denial." I was enjoying the riff, but the chief was not. He cut me short. "Attend the sessions or leave the program." Having few marketable skills and fewer prospects, I attended. But for the remaining 20 or so weeks, I said nary a word in the group. I was occasionally asked why. "I'm in denial," I explained. Don't get me wrong, this was something of an aberration. I had gone to Mass General because it was the most biologically and least psychoanalytically oriented of all the psychiatric programs in the Boston area. Remarkably and brilliantly so, their pharmacological treatments were superb. They pioneered a new method of unilateral electric shock therapy that was astonishingly successful in curing the most profound and recalcitrant depressions. And they even used hypnosis, which I learned to administer to inpatient burn victims in order to block the excruciating pain that accompanies bandaged changes, thus sparing them the need for potentially addictive narcotics. It was a noble life. I remained forever respectful of the work carried out by my colleagues and grateful for my own 7 years there. Medicine, and particularly hospital medicine, which lives in a sea of human suffering, has a way of beating callowness out of even the most self-possessed youth. Its other invaluable residue is best described by Arthur Conan Doyle, himself a physician. The moral training to keep a confidence inviolate, to act promptly on a sudden call, to keep your head in critical moments, to be kind yet strong. Where can you, outside medicine, get such a training as that? Nonetheless, my life as a doctor felt constricted. It was conducted entirely within the four walls of the hospital. Outside, there was a history unfolding to which I felt impelled to contribute, but saw no way to. How to get from here to there? Having moved from New York to Montreal when I was 5, prudently bringing my parents with me, and having not resided again in the United States until medical school, I had few contacts outside Boston and none in politics or journalism. And then pure blind luck. With only a few months left in my residency, a professor with whom I'd written a couple of papers on manic depressive disease was appointed out of the blue by President Carter to head a newly created federal superagency overseeing the National Institute of Mental Health, NIMH. At my suggestion, he took me to Washington to help shape national research on a new diagnostic system designed to move psychiatry from its anecdotal Freudian origins to a more empirical and scientific foundation. It was my go west, young man, moment. Although I knew no one in Washington, I figured it was there that I would find my way back to my long-dormant interest in public affairs. This is no place for an extended biography, so I'll be brief about the unfolding. While working at the NIMH, I began writing articles for the New Republic and was then offered a speechwriting job for Vice President Walter Mondale. It was spring 1980. 6 months of that and our side lost badly. Such was my political career. At which point, the New Republic offered me a job as a writer and editor. I began my new life in journalism on the day Ronald Reagan was sworn in, January 20, 1981. Some of the articles in this book are from those early years at the New Republic. Others are from the monthly back page essay I began writing for Time magazine in 1983. Most of the pieces in this book, however, are from the weekly column I have been writing for the Washington Post since 1984. These quite fantastic twists and turns have given me a profound respect for serendipity and a rather skeptical view about how much one really is master of one's fate. A long-forgotten, utterly trivial student council fight brought me to journalism. A moment of adolescent angst led to the impulsive decision to quit political studies and enroll in medical school. A decade later, a random presidential appointment, having nothing to do with me, brought me to a place where my writing and public career could begin. When a young journalist asks me today, "How do I get to be a nationally syndicated columnist?" I have my answer. First, go to medical school. These turns in my career path were a matter of fate. But there was one other transformation that was not, and it needs a word of explanation. It was deliberate, gradual, and self-driven, my ideological evolution. I'm often asked, how do you go from Walter Mondale to Fox News? To which the short answer is, I was young once. The long answer begins by noting that this is hardly a novel passage. The path is well-trodden, most famously by Ronald Reagan, himself once a New Deal Democrat, and more recently by a generation of neoconservatives, led by Irving Kristol and Norman Podhoretz. Each story has its idiosyncrasies. These are mine. I'd been a lifelong Democrat, and in my youth a great society liberal. But I'd always identified with the party's Cold War liberals, uncompromising Truman-Kennedy anti-communists, led by the likes of Henry Jackson, Hubert Humphrey, and Pat Moynihan. Given my social democratic political orientation, it was natural for me to work for Democrats, handing out leaflets for Henry Jackson in the 1976 Massachusetts primary. Jackson won, I handed out a lot of leaflets, and working for Mondale 4 years later. After Reagan took office in 1981, however, Democratic foreign policy changed dramatically. Some, of course, had begun their slide toward isolationism years earlier with George McGovern's Come Home, America campaign. But the responsibility of governance imposes discipline. When the Soviets provocatively moved intermediate-range nuclear forces, INF, into Eastern Europe, President Carter and German Chancellor Helmut Schmidt got NATO to approve the counter-deployment of American INFs in Western Europe. However, as soon as they lost power in 1981, the Democrats did an about-face. They fell in the thrall of the nuclear freeze, an idea of unmatched strategic vacuity, which would have canceled the American INF deployment while freezing the Soviet force in place. The result would have been a major strategic setback, undermining the nuclear guarantee that underwrote the NATO alliance. Years later, leading European Social Democrats repented their youthful part in the anti-nuclear movement of the early 80s. But the Democratic Party never did. It went even further left. It reflexively opposed every element of the Reagan foreign policy that ultimately brought total victory in the Cold War. The defense buildup, the resistance to Soviet gains in Central America, and the blunt evil empire rhetoric that gave hope and succor to dissidents in the Gulag. Democrats denounced such talk as provocative and naive, the pronouncements of an amiable dunce, to quote Clark Clifford's famous phrase disdaining Reagan. And most relevant now, Democrats became implacable foes of missile defense, in large part because the idea originated with Reagan. The resistance was militant and nearly theological. It lasted 30 years, until, well, today, when a Democratic administration, facing North Korean nuclear threats, frantically puts in place on Guam and Alaska, California, and off the Korean coast, the few missile defense systems that had survived decades of Democratic opposition and defunding. I wrote most of the New Republic editorials opposing the Democratic Party's foreign policy of retreat, drawing fierce resistance from and occasioning public debate with my more traditionally liberal TNR colleagues. My attack on the nuclear freeze, announced the publisher rather ruefully at the next editorial meeting, produced more canceled subscriptions than any other article in the magazine's history. At the time, I still saw myself as trying to save the soul of the Democratic Party, which to me meant keeping alive the activist anti-communist tradition of Truman and Kennedy. But few other Democrats followed. By the mid-1980s, Humphrey and Jackson were dead, and Moynihan had declined to pick up their mantle. The Cold War contingent of the Democratic Party essentially disappeared. As someone who had never had any illusions about either communism or Soviet power, I gave up on the Democrats. On foreign policy, as the cliché goes, I didn't leave the Democratic Party, it left me. Not so on domestic policy. The Democratic Party remained true to itself. I changed. The origin of that evolution is simple. I am open to empirical evidence. The results of the Great Society experiments started coming in and began showing that, for all its good intentions, the war on poverty was causing irreparable damage to the very communities it was designed to help. Charles Murray's Losing Ground was one turning point. Another, more theoretical but equally powerful, was Moncur Olson's The Rise and Decline of Nations, which opened my eyes to the inexorable institutional sclerosis that corrodes and corrupts the ever-enlarging welfare state. The 80s and 90s saw the further accumulation of a vast body of social science evidence produced by two generations of critics, from James Q. Wilson to Heather McDonald, writing in The Public Interest, City Journal, and elsewhere, on the limits and failures of the ever-expanding Leviathan state. As I became convinced of the practical and theoretical defects of the social democratic tendencies of my youth, it was but a short distance to a philosophy of restrained free market governance that gave more space and place to the individual and to the civil society that stands between citizen and state. In a kind of full circle return, I found my eventual political home in a vision of limited government that, while providing for the helpless, is committed above all to guaranteeing individual liberty and the pursuit of one's own million ends of life. Such has been my trajectory. Given my checkered past, I've offered this brief personal history for those interested in what forces, internal and external, led me to change direction both vocationally and ideologically. I've elaborated it here because I believe that while everyone has the right to change views, one does at least owe others an explanation. The above is mine. This book represents the product of that journey. Section 3, A Word on Organization and Method. The body of this book is made up of newspaper columns and shorter magazine pieces grouped by theme in 16 chapters. I have included, however, 5 longer essays on subjects of enough complexity to have required more extensive treatment. The first of these is on the ethics of embryonic research, originally published by the President's Council on Bioethics, of which I was then a member. It is included as the last entry in Chapter 9, Body and Soul. The second essay is a meditation on Jewish destiny, first published in the late 1990s and included here at the end of Chapter 12, The Jewish Question Again. And finally, the book's last chapter, Three Essays on America and the World, is based on three speeches on U.S. foreign policy delivered over two decades about the structure and demands of the post-Cold War international system. Every article in this book, long or short, is reproduced in its original form, except for three considerations. First, I have rewritten some of the headlines. Generally speaking, columnists and essayists don't write their own headlines. Many times I've been dismayed by the editor's ultimate choice, which was often dictated by the space requirement of the laid-out page. That constraint doesn't exist in a book. I am finally released from the tyranny of the one- or two-column head. It's my chance to get it right. I do, however, include the location and exact date of publication of each article to enable those readers enjoying far too much leisure time to consult the original headline if they wish. Second, I altered some punctuation and usage, largely for sake of uniformity. The different publications in which I appear follow different style books. For example, regarding serial commas, whether you write A, B, and C rather than A, B, and C. My syndicated columns adhere to the Associated Press style book. The version appearing in the Washington Post follows the Post's own style, same for Time. As for the others, God knows what they use. To keep the chaos to a minimum, I've tried to impose a consistency in style and usage. This has the welcome subsidiary benefit of allowing me to exercise my petty punctuational prejudices, most importantly, my war on commas. They are a pestilence. They must be stopped. This book is a continuation of that campaign. Finally, I have corrected typographical errors and on rare occasions edited a line or two of text for reasons of obscurity, redundancy, or obsolescence, the last encompassing references so historically obscure today as to have otherwise required cluttering up with explanatory footnotes. Altogether, these are perhaps a dozen or two. They change no meaning. The rest, alas, remains untouched. It stands as it was on the day it was first published, imperfect, unimproved, unapologetically mine. Washington, D.C., August 12, 2013. Part 1. Personal. Chapter 1. The Good and the Great. Marcel, my brother. Place, Los Angeles Area Emergency Room. Time, various times over the last 18 years. Scene, white male, around 50, brought in by ambulance, pale, short of breath, in distress. Intern, you're going to be all right, sir. I'm replacing your fluids and your blood studies and electrolytes should be back from the lab in just a few minutes. Patient, son, you wait for my electrolytes to come back and I'll be dead in 10 minutes. I ran the ICU here for 10 years. I'm pan-hypopit and in circulatory shock. I need 300 milligrams of hydrocortisone right now in a bolus. Right now. After that, I'll tell you what to run into my IV and what lab test to run. Got it? Intern, yes, sir. This scene played itself at least half a dozen times. The patient was my brother Marcel. He later called to regale me with the whole play-by-play, punctuated with innumerable incredulous can-you-believe-its. We laughed. I loved hearing that mixture of pride and defiance in his voice, as he told me how he had yet again thought and talked his way past death. Amazingly, he always got it right. True, he was a brilliant doctor, a UCLA professor of medicine, and a pulmonologist of unusual skill. But these diagnostic feats were performed lying flat on his back, near delirious and on the edge of circulatory collapse. Marcel instantly knew why. It was his cancer returning, the rare tumor he'd been carrying since 1988, suddenly popping up in some new life-threatening anatomical location. By the time he got to the ER and was looking up at the raw young intern, he'd figured out where it was and what to do. I loved hearing these tales, in part because it brought out the old bravado in him. The same covers that in the 1980s, when AIDS was largely unknown and invariably fatal, led Marcel to bronchoscope patients with active diseases. At the time, not every doctor was willing to risk being on the receiving end of the coughing and the spitting up. "Be careful, Marce," I would tell him. He'd laugh. Friends and colleagues knew this part of Marcel, the headstrong cowboy, far better than I did. We hadn't lived in the same city since he went off to medical school when I was 17. What I knew that they didn't, however, was the Marcel of before, the golden youth of our childhood together. He was 4 years older and a magnificent athlete, good ball player, great sailor, and the most elegant skier I'd ever seen. But he was generous with his gifts. He taught me most everything I ever learned about every sport I ever played. He taught me how to throw a football, hit a backhand, grip a nine iron, field a grounder, dock a sailboat in a tailwind. He was even more generous still. Whenever I think back to my childhood friends, Morgie, Fiedler, Clipper, the Beller boys, I realize they were not my contemporaries, but his. And when you're young, 4 years is a chasm. But everyone knew Marcel's rule. Charlie plays. The corollary was understood. If Charlie doesn't play, Marcel doesn't play. I played. From the youngest age, he taught me to go one-on-one with the big boys, a rare and priceless gift. And how we played. Spring came late where we grew up in Canada, but every year our father would take us out of school early to have a full 3 months of summer at our little cottage in the seaside town of Long Beach, New York. For those 3 months of endless summer, Marcel and I were inseparable, vagabond brothers shuttling endlessly on our Schwinns from beach to beach, ball game to ball game. Night and day we played every sport ever invented, and some games like three-step stoop ball and sidewalk spalding we just made up ourselves. For a couple of summers, we even wangled ourselves jobs teaching sailing at Treasure Island, the aptly named day camp nearby. It was paradise. There's a black-and-white photograph of us two boys alone. He's maybe 11, I'm 7. We're sitting on a jetty, those jutting piles of rock that little beach towns throw down at half-mile intervals to hold back the sea. In the photo, nothing but sand, sea and sky, the pure elements of our summers together. We are both thin as rails, tanned to blackness, and dressed in our summer finest, bathing suits and buzz cuts. Marcel's left arm is draped around my neck with that effortless, natural easefulness and touch of protectiveness that only older brothers know. Whenever I look at that picture, I know what we were thinking at the moment it was taken. It will forever be thus, ever brothers, ever young, ever summer. My brother Marcel died on Tuesday, January 17. It was winter. He was 59. The Washington Post, January 27, 2006. Winston Churchill, the indispensable man. It is just a parlor game, but since it only plays once every 100 years, it's hard to resist. Person of the century? Time magazine offered Albert Einstein an interesting and solid choice. Unfortunately, it is wrong. The only possible answer is Winston Churchill. Why? Because only Churchill carries that absolutely required criterion, indispensability. Without Churchill, the world today would be unrecognizable, dark, impoverished, tortured. Without Einstein? Einstein was certainly the best mind of the century. His 1905 trifecta, a total unknown, publishing three papers on Brownian motion, the photoelectric effect, and the special theory of relativity, each of which revolutionized its field, is probably the single most concentrated display of genius since the invention of the axle. The wheel was easy, the axle hard. Einstein also had a deeply humane and philosophical soul. I would nominate him as most admirable man of the century. But the most important? If Einstein hadn't lived, the ideas he produced might have been delayed, but they certainly would have arisen without him. Indeed, by the time he'd published his paper on special relativity, Lorentz and Fitzgerald had already described how at velocities approaching the speed of light, time dilates, length contracts, and mass increases. True, they misunderstood why. It took Einstein to draw the grand implications that constitute the special theory of relativity, but the groundwork was there. And true, his general theory of relativity in 1916 is prodigiously original, but considering the concentration of genius in the physics community of the first half of the 20th century, it is hard to believe that the general theory would not have come in due course, too. Take away Churchill in 1940, on the other hand, and Britain would have settled with Hitler, or worse. Nazism would have prevailed. Hitler would have achieved what no other tyrant, not even Napoleon, had ever achieved, mastery of Europe. Civilization would have descended into a darkness, the likes of which it had never known. The great movements that underlie history, the development of science, industry, culture, social and political structures, are undeniably powerful, almost determinant. Yet every once in a while, a single person arises, without whom everything would be different. Such a man was Churchill. After having single-handedly saved Western civilization from Nazi barbarism, Churchill was, of course, not sufficient in bringing victory, but he was uniquely necessary. He then immediately rose to warn prophetically against its sister barbarism, Soviet communism. Churchill is now disparaged for not sharing our multicultural late 20th century sensibilities. His disrespect for the suffrage movement, his disdain for Gandhi, his resistance to decolonization are undeniable. But that kind of criticism is akin to dethroning Lincoln as the greatest of 19th century Americans because he shared many of his era's appalling prejudices about black people. In essence, the rap on Churchill is that he was a 19th century man parachuted into the 20th. But is that not precisely the point? It took a 19th century man, traditional in habit, rational in thought, conservative in temper, to save the 20th century from itself. The story of the 20th century is a story of a revolution wrought by thoroughly modern men, Hitler, Stalin, Mao, and above all Lenin, who invented totalitarianism out of Marx's cryptic and inchoate communism, and thus earns his place as runner-up to Churchill for person of the century. And it is the story of the modern intellectual, from Ezra Pound to Jean-Paul Sartre, seduced by these modern men of politics and grotesquely serving them. The uniqueness of the 20th century lies not in its science, but in its politics. The 20th century was no more scientifically gifted than the 19th, with its Gauss, Darwin, Pasteur, Maxwell, and Mendel, all plowing, by the way, less broken scientific ground than the 20th. No, the originality of the 20th surely lay in its politics. It invented the police state and the command economy, mass mobilization and mass propaganda, mechanized murder and routinized terror, a breathtaking catalog of political creativity. And the 20th is a single story because history saw fit to lodge the entire episode in a single century. Totalitarianism turned out to be a cul-de-sac. It came and went. It has a beginning and an end. 1917 and 1991, a run of 75 years neatly nestled into this century. That is our story. And who is the hero of that story? Who slew the dragon? Yes, it was the ordinary man, the taxpayer, the grunt who fought and won the wars. Yes, it was America and its allies. Yes, it was the great leaders FDR, de Gaulle, Adenauer, Truman, John Paul II, Thatcher, Reagan. But above all, victory required one man, without whom the fight would have been lost at the beginning. It required Winston Churchill. The Washington Post, December 31st, 1999. Paul Erdős, Sweet Genius. One of the most extraordinary minds of our time has left. Left is the word Paul Erdős, a prodigiously gifted and productive mathematician, used for died. Died is the word he used to signify stopped doing math. Erdős never died. He continued doing math, notoriously a young person's field, right until the day he died last Friday. He was 83. It wasn't just his vocabulary that was eccentric. Erdős's whole life was so improbable, no novelist could have invented him. As chronicled by Paul Hoffman a decade ago in the Atlantic Monthly, Erdős had no home, no family, no possessions, no address. He went from math conference to math conference, from university to university, knocking on the doors of mathematicians throughout the world, declaring, "My brain is open," and moving in. His colleagues, grateful for a few days' collaboration with Erdős, his mathematical breadth was as impressive as his depth, took him in. Erdős traveled with two suitcases, each half full. One had a few clothes, the other mathematical papers. He owned nothing else. Nothing. His friends took care of the affairs of everyday life for him, checkbook, tax returns, food. He did numbers. He seemed sentenced to a life of solitariness from birth, on the day of which his two sisters, ages 3 and 5, died of scarlet fever, leaving him an only child, doted upon and kept at home by a fretful mother. Hitler disposed of nearly all the rest of his Hungarian Jewish family, and Erdős never married. His Washington Post obituary ends with this abrupt and rather painful line: "He leaves no immediate survivors." But in reality he did. Hundreds of scientific collaborators and 1,500 mathematical papers produced with them. An astonishing legacy in a field where a lifetime product of 50 papers is considered quite extraordinary. Mathematicians tend to bloom early and die early. The great Indian genius, Srinivasa Ramanujan, died at 32. The great French mathematician, Évariste Galois, died at 21. In a duel, the night before, it is said, he stayed up all night writing down everything he knew. Premonition? And those who don't literally die young in Erdős's sense. By 30, they've lost it. Erdős didn't. He began his work early. At 20, he discovered a proof for a classic theorem of number theory that between any number and its double must lie a prime, i.e., indivisible number. He remained fecund until his death. Indeed, his friend and benefactor, doctor of math, of course, Ron Graham, estimates that perhaps 50 new Erdős papers are still to appear, reflecting work he and collaborators were doing at the time of his death. Erdős was unusual in yet one other respect. The notion of the itinerant, eccentric genius, totally absorbed in his own world of thought, is a cliché that almost always attaches to the adjective antisocial. From Bobby Fischer to Howard Hughes, obsession and misanthropy seem to go together. Not so Erdős. He was gentle, open, and generous with others. He believed in making mathematics a social activity. Indeed, he was the most prolifically collaborative mathematician in history. Hundreds of colleagues who have published with him or been advised by him can trace some breakthrough or insight to an evening with Erdős, brain open. That sociability sets him apart from other mathematical geniuses. Andrew Wiles, for example, recently achieved fame for having solved math's holy grail, Fermat's Last Theorem, after having worked on it for 7 years in his attic. He then sprang the proof on the world as a surprise. Erdős didn't just share his genius. He shared his money. It seems comical to say so because he had so little. But in fact, it's rather touching. He had so little because he gave away everything he earned. He was a soft touch for whatever charitable or hard luck cause came his way. In India, he once gave away the proceeds from a few lectures he had delivered there to Ramanujan's impoverished widow. A few years ago, Graham tells me, Erdős heard of a promising young mathematician who wanted to go to Harvard but was short the money needed. Erdős arranged to see him and lent him $1,000. The sum total of the money Erdős carried around at any one time was about $30. He told the young man he could pay it back when he was able to. Recently, the young man called Graham to say that he had gone through Harvard and now is teaching at Michigan and could finally pay the money back. What should he do? Graham consulted Erdős. Erdős said, "Tell him to do with $1,000 what I did." No survivors indeed. The Washington Post, September 27, 1996. Rick Ankiel, Return of the Natural. In the fable, the farm boy Phenom makes his way to the big city to amaze the world with his arm. At a stop at a fair on the train ride to Chicago, he strikes out the Babe Ruth of his time on three blazing pitches. Enter the Dark Lady. Before he can reach the stadium for his tryout, she shoots him and leaves him for dead. It is 16 years later and Roy Hobbs returns, but now as a hitter and outfielder, he can never pitch again because of the wound. He leads his team to improbable glory, ending the tale with a titanic home run that, in the now iconic movie image, explodes the stadium lights in a dazzling cascade of white. In real life, the kid doesn't look like Robert Redford, but he throws like Roy Hobbs. Unhittable, unstoppable. In his rookie year, appropriately the millennial year 2000, he throws it by everyone. He pitches the St. Louis Cardinals to a division title, playing so well that his manager anoints him starter for the opening game of the playoffs, a position of honor and, for 21-year-old Rick Ankiel, fatal exposure. His collapse is epic. He can't find the plate. In the third inning, he walks four batters and throws five wild pitches, something not seen since 1890, before manager Tony La Russa mercifully takes him out of the game. The kid is never the same. He never recovers his control. 5 miserable years in the minors trying to come back. Injuries, operations. In 2005, he gives up pitching forever. Then last week, on August 9th, 2007, he is called up from AAA. Same team, same manager. Rick Ankiel is introduced to a roaring Busch Stadium crowd as the Cardinals' starting right fielder. In the seventh inning with two outs, he hits a 3-run home run to seal the game for the Cardinals. 2 days later, he hits 2 home runs and makes one of the great catches of the year over the shoulder back to the plate full speed. But the play is more than spectacular. It is poignant. It was an amateur's catch. Ankiel ran a slightly incorrect route to the ball. A veteran outfielder would have seen the ball tailing to the right. But pitchers aren't trained to track down screaming line drives over their heads. Ankiel was running away from home plate, but slightly to his left, realizing at the last second that he had run up the wrong prong of a Y. He veered sharply to the right, falling and sliding into the wall as he reached for the ball over the wrong shoulder. He made the catch. The crowd, already delirious over the two home runs, came to its feet. If this had been a fable, Anquillo would have picked himself up and walked out of the stadium into the waiting arms of the lady in white, Glenn Close in a halo of light, never to return. But this is real life, and Keel is only 28 and will continue to play. The magic cannot continue. If he is lucky, he'll have the career of an average right fielder. But it doesn't matter. His return after 7 years, if only 3 days long, is the stuff of legend. Made even more perfect by the timing. Just 2 days after Barry Bonds set a synthetic home run record in San Francisco, the natural returns to St. Louis. Right after that first game, La Russa called Anquillo's return the Cardinals' greatest joy in baseball, short of winning the World Series. This from a manager not given to happy talk. La Russa is the ultimate baseball logician. Driven by numbers and stats, he may be more machine than man, but he confessed at the post-game news conference, "I'm fighting my butt off to keep it together." Translation, I'm trying like hell to keep from bursting into tears at the resurrection of a young man who 7 years ago dissolved in front of my eyes. La Russa was required to keep it together because, as codified most succinctly by Tom Hanks in A League of Their Own, there's no crying in baseball, but there can be redemption and a touch of glory. Ronald Reagan, I was once told, said he liked the natural, except that he didn't understand why the dark lady shoots Roy Hobbs. Reagan, the preternatural optimist, may have had difficulty fathoming tragedy, but no one knows why Hobbs is shot. It is fate, destiny, nemesis. Perhaps the dawning of knowledge, the coming of sin. Or more prosaically, the catastrophe that awaits everyone, from a single false move, wrong turn, fatal encounter. Every life has such a moment. What distinguishes us is whether and how we ever come back. The Washington Post, August 17, 2007. Christopher Columbus, dead white male. The 500th anniversary of 1492 is approaching. Remember 1492? In 1492, Columbus sailed the ocean blue. Discovery and exploration, Bolivar and Jefferson, liberty and democracy, the last best hope for man. The left is not amused. In Madrid, the Association of Indian Cultures announces that it will mark the occasion with acts of sabotage. In the U.S., the Columbus in Context Coalition declares that the coming event provides progressives with their best political opening since the Vietnam War. The National Council of Churches, NCC, condemns the discovery as an invasion and colonization with legalized occupation, genocide, economic exploitation, and a deep level of institutional racism and moral decadence. One of its leaders calls for a year of repentance and reflection rather than a year of celebration. For the left, the year comes just in time. The revolutions of 1989 having put a dent in the case for the degeneracy of the West, 1992 offers a welcome new point of attack. The point is the origin. The villain is Columbus. The crime is the discovery, the rape of America. The attack does, however, present the left with some rather exquisite problems of political correctness. After all, Columbus was an agent of Spain, and his most direct legacy is Hispanic America. The denunciation of the Spanish legacy as one of cruelty and greed has moved one Hispanic leader to call the NCC's resolution a racist depreciation of the heritages of most of today's American peoples, especially Hispanics. That same resolution opened an even more ancient debate between Protestants and Catholics over the colonization of the Americas. For Catholics like historian James Muldoon, the Protestant attack on Columbus and the subsequent missionary work of the Catholic Church in the Americas is little more than a resurrection, a few centuries late, of the Black Legend that was a staple of anti-Catholic propaganda during the Reformation. The crusade continues nonetheless. Kirkpatrick's sale kicked off the anti-celebration with his anti-Columbus tome, The Conquest of Paradise. The group Encounter plans to celebrate 1992 by sailing three ships full of Indians to discover Spain. Similar merriment is to be expected wherever a quorum gathers to honor 1492. The attack on 1492 has two parts. First, establishing the villainy of Columbus and his progeny, i.e. us. Columbus is the deadest, whitest male now offered for our detestation, writes Gary Wells. If any historical figure can appropriately be loaded up with all the heresies of our time, Eurocentrism, phallocentrism, imperialism, elitism, and all bad things generally ism, Columbus is the man. Therefore, goodbye, Columbus. Balzac once suggested that all great fortunes are founded on a crime. So, too, all great civilizations. The European conquest of the Americas, like the conquest of other civilizations, was indeed accompanied by great cruelty. But that is to say nothing more than that the European conquest of America was in this way, much like the rise of Islam, the Norman conquest of Britain, and the widespread American Indian tradition of raiding, depopulating, and appropriating neighboring lands. The real question is, what eventually grew on this bloodied soil? The answer is, the great modern civilizations of the Americas, a new world of individual rights, an ever-expanding circle of liberty, and twice in this century, a savior of the world from totalitarian barbarism. If we are to judge civilizations like individuals, they should all be hanged, because with individuals, it takes but one murder to merit a hanging. But if one judges civilizations by what they have taken from and what they have given the world, a non-jaundiced observer, say, one of the millions in Central Europe and Asia whose eyes are turned with hope toward America, would surely bless the day Columbus set sail. Thus, part one of the anti-92 crusade is calumny for Columbus and his legacy. Part two is hagiography, singing of the saintedness of the Indians in their pre-Columbian Eden, a land of virtue, empathy, and ecological harmony. With Columbus, writes Sale, Europe implanted its diseased and dangerous seeds in the soils of the continents that represented the last, best hope for humankind, and destroyed them. Last best hope? No doubt some Indian tribes, the Hopis, for example, were tree-hugging pacifists. But the notion that pre-Columbian America was a hemisphere of noble savages is an adolescent fantasy, rather lushly if ludicrously animated in Dances with Wolves. Take the Incas. Inca civilization, writes Peruvian novelist Mario Vargas Llosa, was a pyramidal and theocratic society of totalitarian structure in which the individual had no importance and virtually no existence. Its foundation? A state religion that took away the individual's free will and crowned the authority's decision with the aura of a divine mandate, turned the Tahuantinsuyo Incan Empire into a beehive. True, the beehive was wantonly destroyed by semi-literate, implacable, and greedy swordsmen, but they in turn represented a culture in which a social space of human activities had evolved that was neither legislated nor controlled by those in power. In other words, a culture of liberty that endowed the individual human being with dignity and sovereignty. Is it Eurocentric to believe that the life of liberty is superior to the life of the beehive? That belief does not justify the cruelty of the conquest, but it does allow us to say that after 500 years, the Columbian legacy has created a civilization that we ought not, in all humble piety and cultural relativism, declare to be no better or worse than that of the Incas. It turned out better, and mankind is the better for it, infinitely better. Reason enough to honor Columbus and bless 1492. Time, May 27th, 1991. Herman Liskow, Man for All Seasons. Herman Liskow, a gifted scientist and legendary teacher, died last week. He was a quiet man from an unquiet place. German-born, he received his medical degree from the University of Berlin in 1936, came to the United States to teach pathology at Johns Hopkins University, and was recruited to the Manhattan Project. In secret, he worked with a team of scientists at the University of Chicago, studying the biological effects of a strange new human creation, plutonium. Later, he was flown to Los Alamos to study the first person to be killed by acute radiation poisoning. Liskow performed the autopsy and later those of eight other victims of accidents at Los Alamos. His findings were a scientific milestone, the first published account of the effects of acute radiation exposure on the human organism. A decade later, he was instrumental in producing a landmark United Nations report on the effects of radiation on humans and on the environment. But Dr. Liskow was more than a scientist. At Harvard Medical School, where he subsequently became a professor, he was the most beloved and influential mentor of an entire generation of students. His home was always alive with the sound of students. He and his wife, Lisa, a formidable intellect in her own right and daughter of James Franck, winner of the 1926 Nobel Prize in Physics, ran a combination halfway house and salon. Medical school is not hard, but it is all-consuming. As our world got narrower, Herman's goal was to keep us human, in touch with a larger world and larger possibilities. He did so in part by example. He was a rare specimen of what used to be called a humanist. His mastery of science was complemented by a deep knowledge of the humanities. With his supple and sophisticated mind, he discoursed easily on art, literature, politics, history. His belief in broad horizons was more than theoretical. He was instrumental in setting up a traveling scholarship for students to take a year off and see the world. He arranged for Michael Crichton to be given the freedom, as a fourth-year medical student, to research and write books. As for me, well, he made my career possible. Toward the end of my freshman year, I was paralyzed in a serious accident. Herman, then associate dean of students, came to see me in intensive care. He asked what he could do for me. I told him that to keep disaster from turning into ruin, I had decided to stay in school and with my class. If Herman had doubts, I would not have blamed him. No one with my injury had ever gone through medical school. He never showed it. He told me he would do everything possible to make it happen. He did. Within a few days, a hematology professor, fresh from lecturing to my class on campus, showed up at my bedside and proceeded to give me the lecture while projecting his slides on the ceiling above me. I was flat on my back in traction, but I'm sure Herman had instructed everybody to carry on as if such teaching techniques were entirely normal. He then went to work behind the scenes, persuading professors to let me take their tests orally with a recording secretary. I did not learn to handwrite for another 3 years. Getting me transferred from my 12 months of inpatient rehab to a Harvard teaching hospital so that I could catch up at night with my class's second-year studies and rejoin it in the third year, persuading, ordering, skeptical attending physicians to allow their patients to be cared for by the student in the wheelchair with the exotic medical instruments. The extra-long stethoscope Herman had made for me was a thing of beauty. Herman did all of this quietly without fanfare. At graduation, he took not only pride, but a kind of mischievous delight in our unspoken conspiracy. We broke no rules, but we bent a few, especially the stupid ones. I'm sure he liked that. That was Herman's great gift. He was a man of orderly habits and orderly mind, but he never flinched from challenging the orderly. In Germany, he had seen order turned into malevolence. Mild-mannered as he was, I never once heard him raise his voice. He was good at defiance. In Nazi Germany, Herman married a Jew, the daughter of an early, very prominent anti-Nazi. Defiance ran in the family. Herman's father was fired as head of Göttingen's elite high school for his opposition to the regime. Herman did not much respect nature strictures either. At age 70, he was still climbing mountains in his beloved Adirondacks. At 80, he was still taking miles-long walks in the woods. And now, just short of 90, he is gone. Those who were touched by this man, so wise and gracious and goodly, mourn him. I mourn a man who saved my life. The Washington Post, August 25th, 2000.